podcast is sponsored by Bel Joyoso Cheese. Bel Joyoso Cheese is a family-owned and operated company specializing in artisan Italian cheesemaking. Using only natural ingredients and fresh, local Wisconsin milk, master cheesemakers handcraft a full line of exceptional cheeses guided by a commitment to quality and a respect for tradition. Ask your distributor about Bel Joyoso's award-winning fresh mozzarella, burrata, ricotta, mascarpone, American grana, and parmesan. At Bel Joyoso, every cheese is a specialty. Hi, and welcome to this week's episode of Extra Serving, a restaurant industry podcast by The Last Bite Network, a product of Nation's Restaurant News and Restaurant Hospitality. I'm your host, Holly Petrie, here with the latest episode. Before we get into that, here's some news from The Last Bite Network that's been happening in the past few weeks. Be sure to check out the latest episode of Takeaway with Sam Okus, featuring Chris Smith, CEO of Zunzi's. Over on Restaurant Hospitality, Brett Thorne's latest episode of In the Kitchen features Michael Reed of Poppy and Rose in Los Angeles. And now it's time to introduce my two co-hosts for this episode.
My name is Sam Okus, Editor-in-Chief of Nation's Restaurant News.
And I'm Lisa Jennings, Executive Editor of Nation's Restaurant News.
Lisa, you're in Los Angeles and it is Super Bowl weekend. LA is playing in the Super Bowl and hosting the Super Bowl. What is it like? What's it like in LA right now?
Well, it's very hot. It's going to be very hot this weekend. So there's that. But people are very excited. The LA Rams are going to win this game and it's going to be so exciting.
No, they're not. They're not going to win, I'm afraid. As the podcast's resident Ohioan, I have to say no. LA is not allowed to have all the nice things. Here's my, I don't mean to climb aboard my soapbox over here, but all you big markets, when you win all your things and everybody's like, oh, what a good story. No, you let the small markets have things from time to time. Cincinnati, they deserve this one. And I'm a team Joe Burrow on this one. Many people know I'm a Cleveland sports fan, which remains true, but I'm a big Joe Burrow fan. So yeah, go Bengals.
Well, we should probably place bets. I mean, I think by the time this is aired, we will know who won. So
that's a good point. This airs today. We're going to be fresh.
Okay.
So, but in a couple of days, okay. What's a good food related bet? Should we just owe each other a meal or something like that?
A meal. How about a meal of our choice? You buy me what I want and I'll buy you what you want.
Got it. Either way, we're going to comp it to the company. Let's be honest, but still.
I was Googling who played in the Super Bowl. That was what I was doing on my phone while you two were talking.
That's a problem, Holly.
Lisa, she had to ask me about what the deal was with Bruno today. Lisa, you don't know either, but.
Because, you know, that song, we don't talk about Bruno. But all I had to do to say, all I had to say to Sam was, why don't we talk about Bruno? And he knew.
Why don't we talk about Bruno?
I mean, I've seen that movie now three times and I listen to the soundtrack at least once complete per day. So I'm pretty much an expert on all of it. But look, as sarcastic as I get about that, it is a fantastic movie. I think among the best I've seen recently, and the soundtrack's great. Lin-Manuel Miranda is a genius and he's raising my children. So
I hope he EGOTs. That's all I'll say.
I do too.
Yeah,
I do too. They picked the wrong song, which I'm just echoing the common sentiment out there. It's a great song that they nominated, but I mean that it's like the fifth best song on that soundtrack. So anyway,
but I wanted to know why we don't talk about Bruno. It's all over TikTok and all they play is just that little bit and then something about a wedding. And that's all I know. So I needed to know why they don't talk about Bruno. And then Sam, you were not very helpful. You said there's magic involved. And then I got lost and I didn't know there's magic in the movie.
I told you needed to watch the movie because I can't explain via Slack why we don't talk about Bruno. You got to go watch the movie. Lisa, have you seen the movie?
No, I haven't seen the movie. And I do have to say that we wouldn't have Lin-Manuel without having West Side Story. And really, you should be talking about West Side Story.
Not the new one, though.
It has far better music.
I had to pause there for a second. I'm like, wait, did he do that soundtrack too? But no. I understand what you're saying. Yeah.
No, but we have to talk about the original West Side Story. The original West Side Story
is the best, but this latest one, I really enjoyed it and I thought it was a lot of fun.
I haven't seen it.
I refuse to watch it.
I don't watch anything but kids movies pretty much exclusively these days. and if I try to watch a movie at nighttime, I will fall asleep in the middle of it.
Well, welcome to my world.
your former world. You're like, yeah, so the world. Yeah,
she has
so
grown up children now.
Yes. I know.
You'll keep I'm me so awake jealous. In other ways, you know, not.
I can't wait for that. I can't wait to just fear for their lives. Yeah, yeah. That's going to be great. Just
it never ends. I'm a full adult and my parents still fear for my life. So it never ends.
Great.
Though I think neither of you think that I'm a full adult. So I think Lisa fears for my life sometimes too.
That's true. Actually, I think I do. I worry.
I was going to say, I feel like we had a whole meeting before Create last year. That was the theme was we're fearing for Holly's life and how do we protect it when we're all in Denver together?
So yes, but it's a constant theme. So I'll learn why we don't talk about Bruno though. I'll learn that this weekend.
Good. That's your homework.
I'll write a report about it.
Great.
All right. Well, here are things that I do know about. Well, actually, I don't know about this first thing. So Lisa's going to have to give us a report on NFTs and the virtual restaurant space. Because this week, Lunchbox and Bear Burger collaborated, or Bear Burger bought Lunchbox's NFT. McDonald's and Panera branching out into the metaverse. What does it all mean, Lisa?
What does it all mean? I mean, really, no one has figured that out yet, but I am no expert here, but what we are seeing is the creep of, you know, the world of Web3 and the blockchain and decentralized finance. All of these things are kind of creeping into the restaurant world, which I think is fascinating. And I think restaurants are trying to find their way in figuring out how to bring their brands to whatever this Web3 will be. And, you know, please remember that it doesn't really exist yet, or at least a lot of people, even Elon Musk, sees it as a marketing buzzword, that it's, you know, the next phase of the internet in some form, but it doesn't, the metaverse, you know, doesn't really exist yet. It's still a concept. So, you know, what's fascinating to me is how these restaurants are kind of positioning themselves to be a part of it in some way. And, you know, we're seeing some very real things. We're seeing restaurants clearly seeing an opportunity for creating some sort of virtual presence in games. We've seen Chipotle do that with Roblox. You know, you could, for their Halloween promotion last year, you could go into a virtual Chipotle and order, and that real food would show up at your door. And so we'll see a lot more of that sort of thing and other marketing gimmicks. And we're also seeing things like, you know, Wings and Rings is allowing franchisees to pay with cryptocurrency, for example, which is kind of an interesting idea. We're seeing this dining club in New York, Fly Fish Club, that is selling membership to the dining club as an NFT. So it's something that actually could create passive income because you can lease your membership to people or resell it, you know, through using cryptocurrency. And there's just all these kind of new ideas cropping up. And will they actually become a real thing? Yet to be determined. But restaurants are going to figure out a way to have a piece of it one way or another.
So the NFT part of this, I think, is the part I don't fully understand, Lisa. I don't know if you've gathered more information in your reporting, but like, in my head, is an NFT essentially like a ticket? I mean, is it you talked about the restaurant that's going to sell membership as an NFT. What makes it significant? What makes the NFT significant to this?
Right. So an NFT is a non-fungible token. And, you know, we've seen it as artwork, for example, or some sort of unique thing, you know, that people can buy. But really an NFT can be pretty much anything that is unique and that, you know, the ownership can be represented uniquely on the blockchain, you know, which is something that is open and transparent. And it, you know, kind of that whole thing takes some explanation. It's, you know, essentially a ledger, you know, that documents who owns what. But what's interesting is that an NFT can be, as we've seen restaurants do now, like this membership, for example. You can, you know, in the real world or the traditional world, you would, you know, pay money and buy a membership. In this case, you're paying cryptocurrency and you own, you know, this membership, which would give you access to eventually a real restaurant when they open it. It hasn't even opened yet, which is kind of an interesting thing. But it's also something that you can sell. So there's a secondary exchange for some of these things. So And that's where I think a lot of people are really interested in cryptocurrency, because, you know, there's this idea that it's an easy way to make quick money. You know, we've seen cryptocurrencies really, which are, you know, just digital assets, grow incredibly in value, but we've also seen them fall in value. They're very risky. They're, you know, if this is something that's not regulated, not insured by the FDIC. I mean, there's all sorts of reasons why this is a very risky thing, but trillions of dollars are being traded in cryptocurrency today. And it is, you know, we've got a stadium in LA that's named after cryptocurrency. People this weekend will see tons of crypto ads watching the Super Bowl. It's a thing. And it's a thing that people have to figure out how to be a part of and understand. But it's, you know, it's something that really, they're believers. There are people who see it as a Ponzi scheme. You have to do your research and figure out whether or not it's something, as a company, as a restaurant brand, you want to, if you want to play this game.
Yeah, I feel like such an old man trying to figure this stuff out. I mean, between cryptocurrency, NFTs, metaverse, I think I get a little bit more, because we've been talking about virtual reality for a while now. And so metaverse, I understand, like, it's kind of like the virtual reality world. The NFT part of it, I'm trying to wrap my head around. And Joanna and I were talking about this morning, though, because she made the reference to how, you know, confusing the internet was at first when it first launched. And, you know, when you look back at some of the old segments of people in the news talking about internet and email, and it was so hard to comprehend. And now, of course, it's just very common. And so these concepts of metaverse and NFTs, I mean, probably 10 years from now, if not sooner, these things will be very familiar to everybody and will be very common. But yeah, I mean, I think, Lisa, to your point about some of the, you know, not controversy, but some of the hesitance with this, all of this, I think the piece of it I get really tripped up on is like the value. I mean, it just feels like we're all sort of ascribing value to things that don't exist. And that gets kind of weird. There's a big novelty component to it too. Like, we just see this rush of people, of brands doing this NFT thing all of a sudden, kind of like a everybody jumping on some bandwagon. They know they have to do it, so that's why they're doing it. And I know, to me, all of that feels like it's just sort of a flash in the pan. But I guess the one thing I would contribute to the metaverse conversation as where I see this being really, really exciting for the restaurant industry is, you know, just thinking about how, you know, the virtual marketplace we've been talking about now for the last couple of years. I mean, DoorDash, you know, the third-party platforms very much being individual virtual marketplaces. The metaverse, you can create an actual marketplace. I mean, the fact that you can not scroll through the app for what you want to eat, but you can, in the metaverse, you know, wander around a food hall and actually look at the menus and the food options. You know, just thinking about how virtual brands, this could be their brick and mortar. The metaverse can be the brick and mortar for virtual brands. There's a lot to be excited about. So as McDonald's and Panera get, you know, this week have registered to go into the metaverse. I mean, it just makes a lot of sense, because you can create an experience in there, much as they are doing within their four walls in the case of restaurants that do have a brick and mortar, but it's infinite. I mean, the metaverse, I think, is infinite, right? So there's just so much more that you can do. And I think that's really exciting to see.
I totally agree with you on that point. But I think there's another thing that is coming out of all of this that I think is super interesting for restaurants, which is that whether you're talking about cryptocurrency or, you know, any kind of NFT sale, we're seeing these communities being created. So for example, you know, Tom Colicchio and Spike Mendelsohn have created this world of Chefty Pizza, where they're selling pizza tokens. And it's something I'm hoping to write about soon. And, you know, in doing all of this, what they've done is created on Discord, which tends to be the social media platform where these things, you know, are these communities are born. They've created this world of people, of like-minded people who are talking about pizza, talking about restaurants, talking about cryptocurrency, talking about all of these things. And they come together in this community and they really engage. And typically, you know, in these sort of communities, there are incentives for engagement. There's, you know, little rewards that they offer. And it could be anything for a restaurant, from free food, you know, to being, you know, to earning tokens, to, you know, anything really, just to get people involved. They have little contests. They have show me your pizza things. They have, you know, there's just, these people are so into it. It really is a full-time job to kind of take part in some of these conversations.
Is there food? Is there food in that example with Spike and Tom Colicchio's example?
Well, they are selling these pizza tokens, you know, and a lot of the community on Discord, the conversations are about pizza. So they have people that post pictures of their pizza and talk about pizza. There's little regional, you know, sub
clubs. But there's no eating pizza.
Well, I mean, I suppose people are going out to eat the pizza or ordering the pizza at some point too. But, you know, most of these people are
a virtual brand. It's like a virtual brand.
I don't think it's going to be a virtual brand. That's not my understanding.
This is where I'm so confused. It's like, if at the end of the day, there's no even food involved. I mean, but point taken, Lisa, I mean, what you're saying is this NFT in particular is again, sort of like a ticket into this exclusive club. I mean, it's the right. Exclusivity that the NFT is ultimately about, but that's where I'm just like in, you know, I guess the difference between a real product and a virtual idea, that's where to me, I'm just like, what are you buying?
Right. Well, the other thing that is part of, so it's building this community, but the other part of it is fundraising. So what we're seeing is a lot of, this has kind of become the new Kickstarter in a way. So another piece of this whole world is this idea of a DAO, of a decentralized organization that is created, that will be in theory run completely democratically by token holders or people who are members of a certain community. And we're seeing people just throwing money at these things to invest in, you know, the idea. So for example, I wrote this week about the Fry's DAO, which is one that's raising money or has raised money up to, I think, close to $5 million now, to create a franchise company. And it was something that just was sparked by a Discord conversation of people, you know, who were talking about, wouldn't it be cool to make a real world example of how you can create this kind of, you know, decentralized organization and run a restaurant, for example, a franchise restaurant in this case. And that's what they're doing. So people agree that this is something that could be done. It has yet to be proven how to do it. And they want to be on the front end of it and figure it out, you know. And, you know, it's really, and there's some restaurant folks involved who said to me, you know, this week, they said, basically, we've seen so much coming out of this pandemic, so much innovation from restaurant companies. And this is just a cutting edge thing that they want to be part of. They want to be, even before the laws sort of build around this, they want to be there to help shape how this comes to fruition, which is just so interesting to me. I mean, it's really, restaurant people are cool in that they, you know, they're okay with risk. I mean, it's a risky business. They are willing to kind of put themselves out there and try new stuff. And I think this is, a lot of this is kind of that spirit, you know, just wanting to be a pioneer.
Well, thank goodness for you, Lisa, because I don't think Sam or I could have talked about any of this.
No, our poor audience wouldn't have learned anything if Lisa wasn't here about NFTs.
Well, I'm not sure I'm teaching anything either, but I do think it's something we all need to understand better. I mean, frankly, we're gonna have to figure this out. And it is, you know, it's kind of coming to reality as we watch it. So it's not like you can say it will be X. We don't know what it's gonna be. We have to wait and see, kind of watch.
That's okay, well, I would love to quickly just cover the Chipotle earnings this week, because Lisa, you did a really great job covering how extensive they were. It's like they were listening to our podcast last week, Sam. They are raising wages.
They must be. Clearly, that was all us, right? We're the only ones with that idea.
Yeah. That was all us talking about it last week, and they must have heard us. And they're raising wages, which I think is huge news. Lisa, can you tell us a little bit about their earnings? Sorry to just kind of throw everything at you this week. We have you on the pod and we're like, Lisa, talk this entire time.
I can talk. Well, I mean, Chipotle did well in the fourth quarter and last year. I mean, they really had a stellar quarter. But, you know, one of the things that came up is the staffing issues. And that was an issue for them last year for many restaurant companies. It was a tough year. There were people out sick. There were people leaving the business. It was tough to get staffing. They had to really find a balance between, you know, the orders that were coming in through delivery and digital and the stores. And it was tough. It was a tough year for them. So they're working on figuring that out. And these are things that they had already been doing. I mean, Chipotle is known, of course, for having great benefits and really investing a lot in their people in that sense. But one of the things last year they did was they said they were going to raise the average minimum wage to $15 an hour. You know, which varies across the country, what that translates to, but they took a hit financially to do that and, you know, raised menu prices to help offset that cost. And it sounds like Brian Nichol is saying he realizes this is, it's not going to stop at 15, that, you know, now a lot of national retailers are looking at $17 an hour. So, you know, you just can't say, okay, we raise wages to $15 an hour. We're done. Okay. All done. We did that. It's going to keep going. And, you know, frankly, we're going to see, I'm sure, Chipotle keep up with that, because as he said, they can't let that, they can't fall behind. You know, they're really trying to be an employer of choice, as many restaurant companies are trying to do. So they're going to have to keep up with wages. And I think we'll see more coming from Chipotle about that investment.
Which, yeah, is, you know, to shamelessly plug my latest episode, A Takeaway, with Chris Smith from Zunzi's, he had this line that I stole and I'm going to use forever. So sorry, Chris. But, you know, he said, you can't pay someone enough to be in the restaurant business. You have to give them something extra. And I thought that was great because, I mean, on one hand, you do have to pay more. I mean, you know, it's not to say that you should just leave it at minimum wage and call it a day. But that, you know, there's a combination here that restaurants really need to do, which is pay your people more and then invest in them in other ways and make them feel good about their job and involve them. And, you know, so I think that's what, for Chipotle, another example of, you know, when it comes to benefits and the way they're investing in general managers and other people, getting them involved, showing them their career in Chipotle and how they can be a part of the growth. I think that's why that's so important, because you do have to show your employees, you know, why are you a part of team Chipotle? You know, what's stopping them from going over and working at McDonald's if they each pay the same wages? They need to believe in the business and invest in the business as much as the rest of the leadership team does. One last thing I'd say about Chipotle too, that I think is interesting is, you know, talking about that idea that some of the smaller markets are, you know, representing a lot of their growth opportunity because they perform so well in smaller towns in particular. And just to, like, as a quick anecdote to back that up, you know, in my hometown, their Chipotle is the nicest quote unquote fast food restaurant in town. And that place is was slammed all the time when I went there. I mean, Chipotle represents something for so many smaller communities that if all you've got is, you know, Burger King, McDonald's, Wendy's, Subway, Taco Bell, when Chipotle comes in, I mean, they can own that town. And it seems to me like that's what they're figuring out. But and when you can own a town like that, there's thousands of those kinds of places across the country. So as they now are upping their projections to get to 7,000 locations, you know, those are the kinds of places that can do it. And it's very interesting to watch.
Well, it will, though, depend on whether or not Chipotle can raise menu prices. And so we will see that also. I mean, they are going to grow their building sales, you know, with their digital emphasis. So they've got this figured out, but, you know, they also do believe they can raise menu prices more. And you know, they know what they're doing in terms of figuring that out. But I do have to say, I have a son who's a huge Chipotle fan. And I'm sure he eats there at least 3-4 times a week. Wow. And he did come home the other day and say to me, you know what? What I order at Chipotle is so much more expensive now. And I really maybe need to think about making another choice. And so I'm saying Chipotle. People are seeing the menu prices go up, and they are, and for a, you know, my son, who's a young kid, just getting started in his career, he's, you know, doesn't have much money. I'm not buying it for him. He's got to buy it himself. You know,
did Chipotle make any comments about Brian Nichol's salary? I mean, we were talking last week about Kevin Johnson's salary and his increase, and Brian Nichol's still the highest paid chain executive. Did they mention anything about that during the earnings in relation to menu increases?
That's not going to come up in an earnings call, I wouldn't imagine. But, you know, Brian Nichol isn't going to mention that. But no, I mean, it's a point to make, although you can also say, you know, Chipotle has done phenomenally well during this pandemic. So, I mean, I'm sure the shareholders are looking at that as at the same time, too.
Yeah. So. Yeah, it's something to think about. I mean, it's something that's caught in my head, especially in light of, we were talking about it last week with Kevin Johnson. I mean, he's the highest paid by millions of dollars. It's not even close. So interesting to see. Yeah, Brian Nichol, not Kevin Johnson.
Well, and what we were talking about last week in particular was not, you know, everybody will have their opinion on whether to pay a CEO that much. The real thing was more the optics of it with Kevin Johnson, that it's, you know, if you're going through this season where you know, it's tough to find workers and, you know, there's pressure to pay more to your employees and you're giving yourself a 40% raise. Not great optics. I mean, not that he's giving himself the 40% raise, but that, you know, he has been given that. And, you know, obviously with these publicly traded companies, we can see that, you know, it's available for us to see. So more that it's regardless of if it's right or wrong, you know, is this the time to give, you know, to get a 40% raise? I would suggest probably not. Maybe wait until, you know, the labor situation has played itself out and you're putting your money where your mouth is, particularly as it relates to how you're paying your workers.
Well, it's interesting to increase the worker pay, but to pay for it with manual inflation and put it on the customers to say, it's almost like, hey, customers, it's your responsibility to pay for workers to have a higher wage instead of putting the burden on the company to find it somewhere in their system. I just find that an interesting way to kind of phrase it.
Well, I'm afraid that is the tradition of the restaurant industry in this country and tipping, you know, that's kind of what it's all based on.
Well,
but I do think
we can do.
Yeah, no, well, there is something we can do. And I think that it also, you know, touches on why we're seeing the rise in unionization. And, you know, we're seeing Starbucks clearly moving that direction, and whether or not that will make the dominoes fall and we'll see unions form in other restaurant companies remains to be seen. But I think it's just a really interesting idea. Fundamentally, people are kind of looking at the workforce situation and thinking that things need to change. It's in a cycle where the worker rights appear to be on the upswing.
Well, worker rights are a conversation for another day. TBD, stay on the seat of your pants for that conversation. Is that the expression? The seat of your pants?
Edge of your seat.
Yeah.
You really are a child. Fly by the seat of your pants is to do something in a knee-jerk reaction.
Stay on the edge of your seat.
Stay on the edge of your seat is anticipation. Wow. We need to do a class on idioms, apparently.
Well, stay on the edge of your seat for that conversation.
She'll be a grown-up someday, dear listener.
My bed is made. See, in the background, my bed is made.
Yeah, okay. One day at a time, you're becoming a grown-up.
that was my resolution for the new year, Lisa, was to make my bed.
I heard. I'm an avid listener, so I would make my bed, but my husband is still in it. It's quite early here, so.
I was like, I'm about to eat lunch. What? That's right. That whole 3-hour thing.
Okay. Well, Lisa, before I ruin expressions for other people, can you tell us about your interview this week?
Oh, this week I spoke with Nick Marsh, who is CEO of Founders Table, which is based in New York. And it's a company that now has three brands, Chopped, Dos Toros, and The Field Trip with JJ Johnson, who was a power lister this year. And it's just a really interesting concept. I mean, this Nick has been around for quite a while and has a great eye for brands. He was an early investor in Mendocino Farms out here in LA, which is one of my favorite brands. And this was a conversation with Nick about what's going on with Founders Table. They just brought in a new partner with Pendulum, which is an investment firm that has some really interesting ideas about franchising and making franchising more inclusive. And so they have some cool things coming. So listen to the interview and he'll tell you all about it.
Definitely take a listen. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Lisa. And as always, thank you, Sam. And stay tuned for the interview.
Okay, so today I have with me Nick Marsh, who's the CEO of Founders Table Restaurant Group. Based in New York, Nick?
Based in New York, yes.
Based in New York, yeah. Thanks for joining us today. So Founders Table was formed in 2020 with the acquisition of Dos Toros Taqueria, which was financed in part by the private equity firm L. Catterton, which was already an investor in Chopped. And the idea at the time was to create a holding company that would look for founder-led, line-out-the-door brands to grow. So Nick, give us an overview of what Founders Table Restaurant Group is.
Sure, Lisa. Thanks. So, you know, we really believe that everything in the restaurant industry begins with one unit, one customer interaction, one founder driving an experience for people in a restaurant. And so the way we describe the vision for Founders Table is around the idea of finding what we call next generation concepts in the fast casual space that are inspired and created by founders. And so, you know, next generation is descriptive, but we give it a specific definition. Founder inspired, better for you ingredients, innovative flavors, and a values driven organization. So hopefully, in short, awesome concepts in a word. And you know, this is what we're focused on and where we believe will be the greatest growth in the restaurant space for the next 20 years.
Okay, so we have three brands, and I'm going to walk you through the three at the moment anyway. It all started with Chopped. We founded it in 2001 by Tony Shure and Colin McCabe. El Catterton invested in 2015. So tell us about Chopped and where it is now.
Sure. Chopped Creative Salad Company is just that. It is a creative, fast, casual salad concept. And there's the approach we use and our approach to salad making is again, inspired by our founders. And what I would say is their never-ending curiosity and excitement around the newest ingredients and spices and flavors being celebrated around, you know, all around the world of food. And so the things that make their way into our salads, we do things like gochujang ranch, and we do Calabrian chili Caesar. Sometimes we joke that we have 100 different Caesars, but there's a little creativity that is the foundation of Chopped. And after this many years, Chopped is pretty dialed in. We have a very consistent prototype. We're in 9 states now. It was always important for us to not just be the salad for the 1%ers, if you will. You know, we didn't want to start in New York City and then jump to Los Angeles for our growth. And nothing against Los Angeles. I personally love Los Angeles, but both financially and from the perspective of the consumer, I think one of the things we are most proud of is that the concept is really well received in all sorts of different markets, different sizes and different demographics. And so that gives us an opportunity. We'll probably build around 20 of them this year.
How many are there now? Did you say the unit count? I missed that.
Sorry, 75.
75, yeah.
Right. So that's a good number for us to build, we think, for the next few years.
So 20 this year. And then are these franchised or are they all company owned?
All company owned.
All company owned.
And so we'll continue in our existing footprint that for now stretches from Connecticut to Alabama.
Okay. And so this falls into fast casual, right? It's a kind of a build your own salad kind of concept. And typically, how big are the units? What do you look for?
They're about 2,500 square feet, you know, which is probably where fast casual starts. We've leaned in very heavy to our digital capabilities at Chopped. About 60% of our sales are digital and about 40% of our sales come through our own app and website. So the configuration of the restaurants has begun to reflect that in terms of pickup areas and making things convenient for the digital customer as well. But it's still a restaurant. You can go and sit down and enjoy your salad on site if you want to do that.
Okay. Okay. All right. So I'm going to bring you back to some questions about that, but let's move on to the number two brand, which is Dos Toros. Founded in New York in 2009 by brothers, Leo and Oliver Kremer, right?
Yep.
Growth Point invested in 2016. And so tell us about where Dos Toros is right now.
Yeah, that's right. I became an original investor in Dos Toros through Growth Point in 2016. It started because I loved the product. I was a customer. We were very fortunate. The first Dos Toros was actually pretty close to what was then the Chopped office. And so had the opportunity to develop a great relationship with the founders, right? And for what we do, the belief that these brands have to have a level of creativity that is driven by sort of very special people with an eye for what they want to create. We had the opportunity to learn a whole bunch and have the organizations kind of get to know each other. I would say Dos Toros differentiates itself with really sort of modern ingredients and a modern twist, right? There is a lean in the burrito space. There's a lean in on vegetables. There's a lean in on a wide range of flavors and sauces that they do really well. at Dos Toros beyond what you would have experienced in a burrito place. We, you know, we do Brussels sprouts, we do pickled onions, we're testing a vegan crema. It's really, you, to use the term again, it's the next generation update on the on the burrito.
Yeah, and how many units
There's 20 units. They're in New York and in DC, started urban, similarly to how Chopped started urban. We'll build four or five this year. We'll go to Washington, DC this year with Dos Toros. And then we think Dos Toros we can build pretty swiftly over the coming years. But we'll see.
Again, all company owned, right?
All company owned.
All company owned. Okay.
I take that back. I apologize. We have one licensed unit in LaGuardia Airport, and that was a awesome deal that we that the Oliver and Leo had created just right around the same time that we actually made the acquisition. And proud to say that of the operator who's in LaGuardia Airport, it's their number one highest performing concept.
Oh wow! Okay. Okay, great. All right. So, and then the third addition to the family is the now, I think, three unit field trip, which is founded by J.J. Johnson, founded in Harlem. Yeah. And so tell us a little bit about where Field Trip is now.
So Field Trip fits exactly into our vision for Founders Table, because it starts with unbelievable food and a passionate, creative founder, right? J.J. is a force. His food is unbelievable. A little bit of a side story. JJ and I are both involved with Wellness in the Schools, which is an organization in New York that brings healthy food into public school cafeterias. And I bring that up because we both spent some time on the issue. How do you get this next generation of food habits and food knowledge into a broader group of places, right? Which is something that we're both super interested in. And, you know, JJ's cracked the code. He developed a healthy bowl concept, rice bowls that combine sustainable and ethically sourced ingredients with a Caribbean cooking style to create totally unique fast casual meals. I don't know if you've ever been, but JJ says rice is culture. Sort of a starting point for Field Trip, meaning that rice is a universal ingredient that can be found at the center of the table in a lot of different communities, which is really where, you know, the ethos of the brand begins. He opened the first one in Harlem, a neighborhood that has historically featured fabulous food, but features a lot more traditional fast food, right, on the quick serve side. And he's had massive success. So we got involved with Field Trip this year. And I mean this totally seriously. My number one rule, whether as an investor or then when I get involved with these early stage concepts, number one rule is don't change it. Don't do anything. Don't change anything, right? Because the founder knows what they are doing, right? The founder knows the customer. The founder understands how their concept, you know, connects to the customer. And it can be very tempting to bring, you know, big company experience or things that we've done. Don't mess it up is really our starting point.
Yeah.
Just get behind him and give him what he needs.
Like doctors, first do no harm.
Honestly, listen, the number of times I've been in a restaurant with people from larger companies and they go into a restaurant where there are lines out the door and they start telling everybody what they got to change to make it better. And we try not to do that. So JJ's opening a couple more units in Harlem and up into Washington Heights, which is upper Manhattan. He's looking at a few trade areas in the Bronx. He really wants to open on or near the campus of one of the traditionally Black universities. He's looking at Howard University in DC. You know, he has a vision for how he wants to grow, and it's super exciting to be his partner.
And with this acquisition, you brought in more funding with the additional partnership of Pendulum, investment firm, and Robbie Robinson has joined your board, coming in from the finance world. And so, you know, Pendulum was created with the idea of reimagining the investment ecosystem to build the next generation of diverse entrepreneurs. And in making the announcement of bringing Pendulum in, Founders Table also talked about really kind of recreating the franchising model and looking at how that could be made more inclusive. And so I wanted to ask you about what that means.
Sure. So, yeah, as you said, Pendulum's focused on investing in and helping to develop, as they say, the next generation of diverse entrepreneurs, right? So they see, and Robbie sees franchising as one vehicle to do that. So I got introduced, I met Robbie through our largest shareholder, L. Catterton, right? And got introduced to his vision. And we started talking about the things that we were each trying to do. And he described, his approach and how he was what they were focused on as an organization. I had been spending time with JJ, who had been talking a lot about how do we broaden the reach of food? How do we enter communities of color? How do we go places where better fast casual is underserved? And Founders Table has been very focused on how do we use the skill set that we have, which is as a slightly larger restaurant organization, right, with some capabilities to execute, to support the growth of smaller companies. And so when we all got connected, we realized we actually all had the same vision. We were just seeing it through different lenses, right? We were seeing it through the lens, Pendulum was seeing it through the lens as an investor. We were seeing it as an operator, JJ as a creator. And we realized that if we could find a way to work together, the total would be maybe better than the sum of the parts.
And so franchising is what comes to mind, but you don't franchise yet, right? So this would be a new thing.
Totally.
Yeah.
And we see that as a positive, because we see that as an opportunity to approach something with a blank sheet of paper. And here's what we think, right? If you talked to 10 growing restaurant companies who are all in the process of considering or beginning or starting a franchise program, it is very likely they'd all be looking in the same direction to attract the same group of existing, established, successful franchise companies, right? And there are a number of people who have had success in doing that. And so really, as Robbie says, right, let's give them a different direction they can look in, right? What if JJ created a concept that's a little different from your typical fast casual concept? And what if Pendulum made financing for diverse franchisees a little bit more accessible? And what if Founders Table focused its resources on supporting this new network, right? If we put those three things in place as we start to launch a franchising program around all of our concepts, really, Chop or Dos Toros or Field Trip, right? Who could we attract to that universe and what kind of opportunities could we create?
That's so interesting. So it sounds like you have a vision, but you haven't actually put this into play yet. You're still talking about how to do this.
So here's what we're trying to do. Restaurant companies are massively people intensive, right? We have about 3,000 people in Founders Table. We want to be a positive generation of opportunity in employment, right? As the first rung of the ladder for a lot of people. And without going too far astray, but you know, Chop has been in business for 20 years, Dos Toros for 13 years. That's a lot of people coming through the door who we have an opportunity to impact. And I would tell you, our track record is good as restaurant operators, right? We have 75% diverse management, 50% of our managers are female, over half our managers are internally promoted. I'll keep going if you'll let me. Our average manager tenure is over 5 years, right? Our average district manager tenure is over 10 years. So we're very solid citizens, and we've had a long-term focus on creating a career path. So what I would tell you is that the vision for what we're trying to do here is one that has begun a long time ago, and it is about how do you extend a career path in a really, really meaningful way? And we actually see this as the last piece in the puzzle. Because what we believe and what Robbie believes is that where the magic happens is with ownership,
right?
And taking that track record of development, but right, creating ownership. So the partnership with Robbie and JJ is about helping to extend a career path that can lead to ownership, and where we want to put the stake in the ground. That's where we want to put the stake in the ground for Founders Table.
So you're talking about investing in people. Basically, which is, you know, something that we're hearing from a lot of the kind of the people who are looking at disrupting franchising are doing that. And it's so interesting to see how they're doing that. So if you can give more detail on that, too. But it sounds like you're also talking about creating brands specifically for that path to ownership. Is that right? So not necessarily taking the three that you have now, but perhaps a franchise specific brand or adding to the group?
We have two different pieces we want to put together. Okay. We will continue to invest in other brands that meet the criteria that we sort of have laid out that I told you. One of the things that I always say is we will only ever do something if our founders, Tony and Colin and Leo and Oliver and JJ, if they'd be massively proud to have their names associated with that brand as well, right? So I think the way we think about brands is as I described at the beginning, which is really leaning in on making sure that we have the creativity and the quality that we believe this is something that can launch into the next generations. And then, you know, as you described, the answer is yes, right? Like we are in absolutely entrepreneurial phase where we have this vision that has come together with hopefully a few special people that are focused on something. And we will find the pathway, right? We will find the best pathway to help make that grow.
So it sounds like you might be looking for more acquisitions.
It is definitely possible. Yeah, I mean, look, we honestly, Lisa, we love what we're doing, right? I think that the thing that is maybe unique and is unique for me also, and I'll answer a question that you didn't ask, but I started as a founder in this industry, right? I love being a founder. I have total and complete respect for the magic that the founders bring to the table. I'm trying really hard to create, you know, I believe I can, that in this platform, we can use technology, we can use real estate knowledge, we can use access to capital, we can use the established management team that we've had that can help some of these great concepts that exist in our industry find the escape velocity to get to that next level of size. And you've been covering the restaurant industry for a long time. I've been doing this for a long time. You see a lot of great concepts that sometimes don't make it to the next level, right? And it's because you need a little bit of these balance of skill sets, and you need a healthy respect for what the other, you know, for what the other person is bringing to the table. So, yeah, like when the best part of my job and the most fun thing that we do is when we're out in the field and we're experiencing new things and meeting new people and learning all like the other great things that are going on in this industry.
Well, so I was going to ask you to give us a little bit more of your background because you've been, you know, in the industry for some time. And did it start with, is it Zando Coffee and Bar?
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Tell us your backstory.
Like so many people in the restaurant industry, I had an idea, right? Like I was inspired by something I'll take you all the way back. I was right in the mid 90s. I was the first massively passionate customer at Starbucks, right? Like I thought Starbucks was the greatest thing that had ever been invented. But I joke, Lisa, that I was in my mid 20s. So the only thing I could think of to make Starbucks better was to put booze in there. So we created a concept that was coffee and bar, you know? And we called it an American version of a European cafe. And you all know what? It was a great idea.
Yeah.
It was great. People loved it. We had and you know what we really could have used when we had about 20 restaurants?
You.
A platform of growth, somebody to help us, somebody to help us miss a few of the pitfalls.
Yeah.
You know? I absolutely think back to those experiences all the time. I think back to the things that I was fortunately able to do pretty well. And I spent a whole bunch of time thinking about the things that I did not do well, right? And my experience over the past, you know, 15 years after that is that, man, it's the same pitfalls for a lot of concepts, right? There's a lot of the same things that are stumbling blocks. And then today, the extra one, which I think leads to what we're doing, the extra twist of difficulty is the reliance on technology in our industry, right? Because now all of a sudden you're playing in a place where you, no matter how great you are, you can't, like, you need a certain size and scale in order to compete effectively with technology in the restaurant industry today, right? Like, you know, if you go out and you use your Starbucks app or your Panera app, and then you go use, you know, the app from a small company, you don't discount that it's a different experience because they're a small company, your customer. You just want it to be great, right? And so it, on top of the historical challenges of growing your own brand, how you are going to navigate the world of technology is another place where we've invested massively, right? And so it's a skill set and an asset that we can bring to some of these smaller companies.
Okay, let me bring you back to that point, but I want to tell your story a little bit more. So you know, so we had Zendo Coffee, you had lessons learned there. Cozy Restaurants, I think, was also in your background. And you were an early investor in Mendocino Farms here in LA, which is, you know, fantastic brand and has done really well.
Correct.
And then, of course, Talked, which, you know, set you on the path you're on now. Correct. Is there anything else that we're missing that we need to mention?
No, you got them all.
Okay.
Yep, those Toros field trip. That's all.
Okay. But so early on, you were, I remember from our earlier conversation back in Mendo days, you were a believer in slow growth. And so at the time you were, you know, I think the first investment in Chopped was something like 1.5 million, but it grew over time. But you at the time were saying you really felt it was too risky to grow too fast for some of these emerging brands. Have your views on that changed as you grow these three and look at more?
Honestly, no. Really, bullet point one is keep the wheels on the car. You know, even with the resources of a larger organization, are you able to accomplish a little bit more? Sure. But, you know, the restaurant industry, you're still bound by good real estate sites and great people to run each unit, right? And so absolutely, you know, training systems, development systems, recruiting systems, we're able to support the growth of young brands. But we don't think there's a magic bullet, and we still think you have to be careful of not getting out ahead of yourself.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. So back to your investments in technology, and this could also, you know, you've got these three brands. Are all of your restaurants? I haven't added them up as we go. How many restaurants that you operate now? Are they all open fully, as, you know, post pandemic, or are you still dealing with getting restaurants open and operating hours?
Everything's open now. I think we might have one. We might have one restaurant in New York that is not open yet. But other than that, we're pretty much all back.
So you mentioned that, you know, that digital has become a much bigger part of the business, you know, and the investments in technology. Do you feel like you will be able to find that balance between digital and in store?
Yeah. So we're really excited. In a few months, we're opening up what we are referring to as our restaurant of the future, but we have sort of a fully reimagined, you know, if you brought the best of digital and you brought the best of convenience, but you integrated it in a place that you wanted to be hospitable and still be a great experience for the guest. We did a little reimagining on that. So we're opening a Chopped location, in probably May or June in New York City to try to capture that.
And what features will it have? Can you describe what it'll be?
It will be completely digitally enabled, so that all the ordering will be through through mostly order ahead for pickup and delivery, but there will be the ability to order in house. It's one of those things that's hard to describe, Lisa.
So no dine-in. I mean, you can.
There will be full hospitality. There will be full human interaction. There will be, you know, one of the things that was critical, you'll be able to see the people making your food, right? Like, I think that at the end of the day, we do think that no matter how effective your technology becomes and how convenient you can make your restaurants, which we think is super important, you know, just making it unbelievably convenient for people. But we do believe that restaurants, you know, the important part of restaurants is creating a connection, right? That there is a connection with the consumer. And it is important that a part of that is not through a screen, right? So we're creating a restaurant that captures a lot of our values, you know, allows you to see and understand what we do and the ingredients we do it with. And it also gives you an environment there. If you want to come in and sit down with, you know, eight of your friends around a table, you can come in and do that and be served at your table. And it will hopefully, that will be the most convenient way you could do that.
So you're not looking at ghost kitchens or, you know, doing something completely off premise?
We don't have any plans for specific ghost kitchens right now. We're exploring that idea. I think this idea is sort of our evolution of what ghost kitchen could become. How do you create a digitally enabled environment that makes the experience better? It doesn't fully replace the old experience.
Yeah. Okay. So more to come on that.
I'm not hiding anything from you, Lisa. I'll have to work on how I describe it verbally, but it'll be, I'll meet you there. And we'll have a salad as soon as.
Okay. Sounds good. Okay. So I just want to bring you back to one point though. So back to the idea of franchising, you know, and what might come, you know, the path to ownership. You know, there are folks in the industry who feel that some people have been historically, you know, disempowered, have been, you know, not really had access to franchise ownership. Do you agree with that? And what do you feel needs to change?
Yeah, I think I don't want to I don't want to repeat myself, but you know, again, I do think that a lot of times the easiest things for people to do is to look around and see how people before them did, right? That's a lot of times that's how we gain our experience, right? And so what we're saying is, can our starting point be by figuring out how we use all of these three sort of unique resources coming together to work together and create and use each of our networks, right, to sort of head off in a different direction. And so I think that you know, Pendulum is a huge part of the story, right? Because providing financing is a critical part to getting franchising going, right? And so, you know, we think that with amongst all of our networks, we will be able to do something that's a little bit different than the way most companies go after their franchising.
Okay, all right. So we'll follow you and see what happens. Thank you so much for spending this time, Nick. I really appreciate you catching me up on what's happening with Founders Table. It sounds exciting. It sounds like there's going to be some more to come this year.
Thanks, Lisa. Thanks for taking the time.
Okay.
This podcast is sponsored by Bel Joyoso Cheese. Bel Joyoso Cheese is a family-owned and operated company specializing in artisan Italian cheesemaking. Using only natural ingredients and fresh, local Wisconsin milk, master cheesemakers handcraft a full line of exceptional cheeses guided by a commitment to quality and a respect for tradition. Ask your distributor about Bel Joyoso's award-winning fresh mozzarella, burrata, ricotta, mascarpone, American grana, and parmesan. At Bel Joyoso, every cheese is a specialty.